My name is Luther Peterson, or Lute, as those call me who have difficulty with two syllables. And the topic for our week, it's a Bible study of the book of Ecclesiastes, is what it is. The search for meaning. The search for meaning, and today we'll talk about, a little later, as soon as we do some work of introduction to the book of Ecclesiastes, we'll talk about the person who has tried all kinds of forms of pleasure and has not succeeded in finding any meaning in life. But let's begin with a word of prayer. Oh God, we thank you for this beautiful new day, for the gifts of grace, for the gifts which you give us. We ask that you would help us to appropriate these gifts fully and to see them as from your hand and to use them joyfully. Open our hearts and minds to hear your word. Inspire us by your Holy Spirit. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Today we talk about the person who has attempted to make sense of life by preoccupation with pleasure. But before we actually get into that, let's get a little introduction to the book. The overall plan of our session today is first of all, to spend a little more time on introduction to the book of Ecclesiastes, and then some time on the topic of the person, this person who's reached middle-aged crisis and discovered that nothing's meaningful anymore, including all the fun that he's been having. It's all become kind of a dead end. We'll also look at some ways that we might help people. Keep this in mind. Keep looking for things in the book of Ecclesiastes and in the other things that we study to see if you can find some clues about how you might help your friend, whether it's a high school classmate or college classmate who's come to that point, or a person in middle age, or a person who's older, and you know very well what they've been trying is mostly pleasure, mostly the pursuit of happiness, which, as Harold Kushner says, is okay to have it in the Constitution, but it's not okay to have it as your main pursuit in life. It doesn't work. And you kind of know that they've been living that way. Maybe they're hedonists. Maybe they're just people that are just trying to have fun all their life. And you sense a disillusionment in their life. And maybe they say some things to you. Maybe they don't. But what can we find in the book of Ecclesiastes and in a couple of New Testament passages that we'll look at? What can we find that may be of some help for you as you relate to that person? Keep that in mind as we go through these studies today. Well, the book of Ecclesiastes is a cynical book. As Lily Tomlin is quoted to have said, "No matter how cynical I get, I can't keep up." And that's a little bit of the way this author feels. Or you could put it like the Peanuts cartoon, as we often quote Peanuts. This little sister Sally is... She comes running into the room. She's all excited. And there's Charlie Brown sitting in his beanbag chair. And she comes up behind Charlie and she says, "I've decided to embark on a program of serious discipline. I'm going to eat properly, sleep properly, and exercise properly." And she waits. And Charlie Brown's sitting there. He's looking at TV set. His eyes don't waver. And he simply says, as he continues to watch TV, "Then what?" And then she says, as she walks away, "Okay, you're right, forget it." Well, again, that's a little bit like what we see in the book of Ecclesiastes, a little bit of the feeling that you get that the author has. When I say the word Ecclesiastes, what comes to mind for you? What word association, what do you think about when I... I just lost my connection here. I didn't wear the right kind of shirt. I've got it again. No, I didn't wear the right kind of shirt today. I was
have money.
Wasn't I? Yeah, let's change shirts. Talk about helpful. I mean, give you the shirt off his back. Okay, I just got the wrong kind of shirt on, so it keeps popping out. Okay, now I know enough not to wear this in the morning. Okay, what pops into mind? When I say the word Ecclesiastes, what pops into mind for you?
For me, it's always, there's a season for everything.
That's the very famous passage. And we'll look at that one tomorrow, especially, by the way, the one that talks about time. Because we want to look at, see what Ecclesiastes, how he uses the word time, and the fullness of time, being the Galatians 4 passage, which talks about time and Christmas and the coming of Christ. And we'll look at that stuff tomorrow. But that's one of the most famous ones. Okay, so we associate, you sing it at weddings.
Can you repeat what she said? Because we can't hear what they say out there.
Oh, yeah, she said what she connects with Ecclesiastes is that very famous passage in the third chapter, which says there's a time for everything. A time to be born and a time to die. The famous song that... How many of you have heard that sung at weddings? Yeah, many, many of us have heard that sung at weddings. Anything else that comes to mind when I say the word Ecclesiastes?
You asked for one word, wisdom.
Wisdom, okay. It's part of the wisdom literature, and there's stuff about wisdom in it.
Vanity?
Vanity is a key word. What else? Anybody? What do you connect with the word Ecclesiastes, with the book of Ecclesiastes? Well, of course, it's an Old Testament book, first of all. All right. And as I always say, and I continue to say, one reason it's important to keep the Old Testament and the New Testament together is that the Old Testament keeps rubbing our noses in the real world. And that's helpful. It's about meaning, the search for meaning. And it raises the question of whether good triumphs over evil or does evil triumph over good? You could put the question this way. Is Macbeth right when he says that life is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing? Is that what life is all about? Or is Teilhard de Chardin right when he says that something is afoot in the universe? Take your pick. What's your philosophy of life? You know, which of these two comes the closest for you? And that's the important question. The Bible contains, and it's often in highly poetic form, some interpretive helps for us as we deal with that question. You know, which is it? Which is it that best describes what reality is all about? The only book I ordered for the bookstore this week is Harold Kushner's little book, When All You've Ever Wanted Isn't Enough. It's a commentary on the book of Ecclesiastes, what it is. How many of you have already read that book? Now, they do have copies in the bookstore. They say they've got lots of them. I have a reading list also if you want to, when you get out of here and decide you want to read a half a dozen books on Ecclesiastes, you can pick up one of these. And I have a few of them with me. They also have one copy left of A Cry of Absence by Martin Marty. I should have ordered that because that's such an excellent little book that deals with the feeling of emptiness and nothingness and grief and sadness that comes over us at certain points in our life. And super good book. They have one copy left. I believe it's hardback, but they're, you know, whoever can run the fastest can buy it after the session if you want to. Harold Kushner has, of course, some neat ways of putting things, and he's a Jewish rabbi, so you don't have the benefit of the New Testament, and so we can add that ourselves as we study the book of Ecclesiastes in the context of the entire Bible. But Harold Kushner has some excellent stuff. For instance, one of his chapter titles, all of his chapter titles are rather intriguing, but this one I especially, was there something I was supposed to do with my life? And just again, let me just quote a couple of little things out of the introductory part. He quotes Carl Jung in Modern Man in Search of a Soul. He's a psychoanalyst, psychiatrist, who said, about a third of my cases are suffering from no clinically definable neurosis, but from the senselessness and emptiness of their lives, which he describes as the general neurosis of our time. He uses an interesting illustration which sharpens this up for us, if we needed that. The curator of a butterfly museum in South Wales once introduced me to the moth with no mouth, a species of caterpillar that lays its eggs and then changes into a moth that has no digestive system, no way of taking in food, so that it starves to death in a few hours. Nature has designed this moth to reproduce, to lay eggs, and pass on the life of the species. Once it has done that, it has no reason to go on living, so it is programmed to die. Are we like that? Do we live only to produce children, to perpetuate the human race? And having done that, is it our destiny to disappear and make way for the next generation? Or is there a purpose to our existence, simply beyond simply existing? Does our being alive matter? And then here he says, would our disappearance, here's a good question, would our disappearance leave the world poorer or just less crowded? Think about that. As Jung correctly understood, these are not abstract questions simply suitable for cocktail party conversation. These are desperately urgent questions. We will find ourselves sick, lonely, and afraid if we cannot answer them. So what we're doing here is rather critical, it seems to me, a kind of reflection and study as we look at this book of Ecclesiastes. I got to tie this on tighter again. Okay, the book of Ecclesiastes. Where does it fit? It fits into the wisdom literature, as we said. What are the other books of wisdom literature in the Bible? Quickly, anybody?
Proverbs.
Song of Solomon. Okay, Job. Where does it fit in the wisdom literature? Okay, the book of Proverbs now. I mean, the book of Proverbs says, if you live carefully and wisely, what will happen? Anybody? Prosper? Okay, you'll prosper. What else? Things will go good or bad for you. They'll go good for you. Right. Both Job and Ecclesiastes say, wait a minute, it's not quite that simple. You have this interesting conversation, again, going back and forth between books of the Bible. The book of Job says, here's a wise man who lived rightly, he did everything right, and the bottom fell out of his life, right? However, what happens at the end for the book of Job? Things turn out okay. Okay, so the book of Job, it raises the question, but Job comes out okay in the end. The book of Ecclesiastes, however, simply says, wait a minute, it's not that way. It's not that simple, and it doesn't come out all right in the end like the book of Job does. It just simply raises the question and disagrees with the author of Proverbs. So That's where it fits into the wisdom literature. Is the book a prayer? No, it's not a prayer like the book of Psalms. It's a book where he refuses to address this to God. He simply talks to himself and talks to his friends. And yet, the amazing thing about this is that he refuses to commit suicide. Because it has so many gloomy things in it that you'd think that would be the next natural result. As with the book of Proverbs, it is addressed to young men. It's rather difficult to read the book of Ecclesiastes and use inclusive language. We need to make the attempt, but it was originally designed for young men. What's the other name for the book of Proverbs? I mean the book of Ecclesiastes. The preacher. Okay. Okay, some of you pastors or theologians, what is the other name for the book of Ecclesiastes that means the preacher? Kohelet. Did I spell that right? I better look at my notes. Yeah, sometimes there's an H on the end. It's used either way. Right, okay. Some of you just didn't want to be, you're too modest to tell me, so I had to write it on the board. Anyway, Kohelet is a nickname for Solomon. It simply means the preacher. It means the philosopher. It's likely not a personal name. No one knows quite for sure why he used this title, but Kohelet means, it's a Hebrew word, which means the speaker in a religious assembly. The person that gets up and leads a religious assembly. Now let's watch how this makes a connection with the word Ecclesiastes. When the Old Testament was translated into Greek, when they translated the word the book of Ecclesiastes into Greek in the Septuagint, the Greek word for assembly of believers is what? Ecclesia, right. And so we come up with in the English the word Ecclesiastes, or the preacher. Okay, this is all just things you couldn't live without knowing. You just had to know this before you get into the book of Ecclesiastes. Okay, when was it written? It's likely was written somewhere very late, maybe about 250 BCE, as we say, or BC, whatever you want to call it. Long time after the glorious days of the kingdom, when all they, in their immediate history, their memory was not a memory of glory and great and wonderful nation and all the rest, but it was their memory was destruction and exile and the disintegration of their country. While previously the people had thought of themselves as part of a group, part of a community, by the time they got to this point in their history, they were thinking more like me, myself, thinking of themselves in individual terms first, and only secondarily as part of the group. And we talk about this today as being a problem. Our what? Individualism. Our rugged individualism. We don't have the feeling of being a part of the community of the people of God. And so this was becoming a part of the problem already in those days. Certainly he took the name of Solomon. Solomon, who lived hundreds of years before. It was his namesake. But that was a common thing to do among the authors of those books. Okay? Let's look at the first verse. 1:1. Or the first two verses. Would one of you read the first two verses of the book? Just go ahead and read it. Anybody? Yeah, out loud. Yeah, just read it good and loud for us.
Right.
The word of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Variety of varieties, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is a vanity. Two of them or all of it?
The two verses, yeah. Okay. Right. That's two verses. Yeah, okay. What's the word repeated there?
Vanity.
Vanity. Vanity. What does that mean? Variety. Nothing's any use. What else?
Proud.
Pardon?
Proud.
Proud. Yeah, pride. Okay. Okay. You stand in front of the vanity and look at yourself. Other word association. What do you think of when I
self-centered?
Self-centered. Okay. Okay. The word is used 20 times in the book. It's a very key word in the book. It has. You know, these Hebrew words have pictures. This is a picture of, I don't know if you've taken a shower in one of these rooms up here where you get, by the time you're done taking a shower, everything is all steamed up. But you open the window and what happens? The mist disappears. Everything's all clear again. That's kind of the picture you have of the word vanity. That life is sort of like that mist. It's on the mirror, you know. It's nothing, not much there. It's just almost, it's gone almost right away, and you can't get a handle on it. And it's like a breath, like a mist. That's the picture we have. He says life is like that. And then he cites all kinds of evidence as we look at, as we search, as we go through the book. How many of you, if we were to take a vote in here now? Suppose I hadn't already said anything about Ecclesiastes. How many of you would say the book is completely gloomy, and how many of you would say the book has elements of hope? Let's just have a raise of hands. I'm not going to count, but how many of you say it's just completely gloomy, just from what you've read? Not okay. You're just like that group earlier. You don't want to commit yourself. Okay. How many of you think there are elements of hope in the book? What an optimistic group we have, or else you know more than you want to admit. Okay. All right. Well, I would say that it has elements of hope. But there is a controversy raging among Bible scholars, and they're sort of evenly divided as to whether this book is predominantly a book of gloom or whether the book has very, very strong elements of hope. I am very biased. I come at it from the viewpoint that it is a very strongly, that it does have some strong elements of hope, and in spite of the way it sounds. Martin Luther, by the way, I talked to Diane Jacobson, professor of Old Testament at Luther Northwestern, several months ago. I said, give me a reading list for this book of Ecclesiastes. Well, start with Martin Luther, she said. He's probably the best commentator yet that we've got on the book of Ecclesiastes. And Martin Luther is very optimistic, has some beautiful things to say about the hope and the help that's in the book of Ecclesiastes. I believe this one's in the library, volume 15 of Luther's works, in case you want to go into more detail on that. And I'll be quoting from Martin Luther because, well, you know how much he's kind of fun to quote from. He's such a earthy way of saying things. And we'll come to some of that. By the way, just to comment on the bibliography, if anything you find by Crenshaw, James Crenshaw, this is one of his books. This is the Old Testament Library Commentary on Ecclesiastes. Anything by Crenshaw is excellent. He's a contemporary scholar, and anything by R.B.Y. Scott, and this was called The Way of Wisdom. I'm not sure if this is up there or not. I didn't look for that one. But anyway, anything by one of those two authors is very well worth your time if you want to do extra work in this particular book. And there's another scholar whose name is Huebray, who wrote in the Journal for the Study of the Old Testament. He makes this comment. If Ecclesiastes were basically a book of gloom, then there are many verses that would be a real problem. There are at least seven sections in the book where, and these sections kind of build to a crescendo, if you look at them, where you have some real help. And he says the key word in this book, if you want to find some help here, is the word gift. The word gift. Watch for that word as we go through the book this week. It says, all the depressing considerations, evil, death, boredom, futility, vanity, are turned by Koheleth into positive incentives to enjoy all the more what God gives us in the present. Well, again, this to say more about this book, it's more like a journal than a theological textbook. Therefore, it's difficult to outline. I just tried over and over to try to outline this book, to find five neat sessions, you know, five neat topics. And first of all, there are more than five in the book, and so you have to read the book yourself to get the full benefit. But I tried to find five main themes. And then also, I said, well, now I want to find a Bible passage that has to do with, you know, the person that's tried all forms of pleasure, the pursuit of happiness. And so I found one, but it has other themes running through it. It's written like a journal. And so when we come to passages and when I ask you to read something, you'll see other elements of things we're going to talk about later in the week, like the person that's the workaholic, he's tried work, the person that's tried, these various kinds of things. A person that has spent a lot of time trying to figure out time and the meaning of time and the shortness of time, which we're going to look at tomorrow, and the fullness of time. What are some of the other basic themes? Wisdom. You know, try to become a real scholar, really learn everything, and run into a dead end. You know, all these different kinds of themes that we find in the book, and they kind of interweave, but some have predominant kinds of things. Well, we're looking at the word pleasure today. A person who has tried the pursuit of happiness. How many of you belong to a YMCA or a health spa? Raise your hand. Well, some of you have. This is a very popular thing nowadays. I suppose that's one attempt to try to find happiness. Let me just tell you what I heard on the radio not long ago, an advertisement for a health spa. Here's what it said. We realize that bulging biceps can't compensate for the blank expression on your face. What were they trying to say? What was that trying to say? We offer more than bodybuilding at our place. Anyway, it all has to do with this business of pursuit of pleasure. There are many different ways that we could, evidence that we can find of this attempt to try to find some meaning, find some kind of a meaning in life by the pursuit of recreation, pleasure. Let's look at chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. Remember to keep in mind the question, the original question. We're going to break up into some groups of some triads toward the end of the time today, groups of three. And for a short time, we aren't going to do it right now, but after a little bit, and where I want you to struggle with that question, how would you help somebody? What would you say to them to try to help them? A friend who has tried pleasure, every form of pleasure there is, and has come up bankrupt and meaningless. Their life is meaningless. But let's look at chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. It's kind of up here too. It's shopping. Shopping. You want to hear that? You want to see where that is? It's in verse 10. Whatever my eyes desire, did not keep from them. That popped into my mind anyway. I don't know. Maybe that's not legitimate. Are these things bad? Maybe concubines, but otherwise they're all good things, aren't they? Okay, alcohol for some is a taboo. Others, it's something used in moderation, and it's okay. But anyway, basically what we have up here are a lot of good things. Martin Luther, okay, we'll start to quote Martin Luther now. Martin Luther says, it's as though, when he's commenting on the phrase, "Come now, I will make a test of pleasure." It's as though he were saying, since anxieties and my own plans, my work, cannot bring satisfaction, I will refrain from them for a bit. I shall turn and make a more tranquil life for myself. No, none of us ever feel that way, do we? He says, and here's another one. Often dinner parties are arranged to create a happy atmosphere. Let's have a party. We're going to have fun. With foods and entertainment intended to make the guests happy. But usually, it comes out just the opposite way. And only seldom does a good party result. Either there are gloomy and solemn faces present, or something else upsets all the arrangements, especially when there is such deliberation and planning. We've worked so hard on this party about how much fun it will be. Does that ring a bell for anybody? You've never had any disappointing parties, have you? By contrast, it often happens when someone happens upon a most joyful dinner party by accident. It's just sort of a gift of God. Same thing happens in other areas of life. Now, what happens? Another way to cope with this. Okay, suppose you've tried all this stuff and you say, I know what I'll do. I know what the answer is. I won't do any of this. Doesn't work too good. I will abstain from all these things. Then I will find happiness. Has anybody ever tried that? Have any of you ever tried that? No. Have any people in history ever tried that? Who? The monks, the monastic movement. The monastic movement is a very good thing in its basic focus, but it can be used the wrong way, and it has been used the wrong way as an escape, as a way of attempting to escape from all these good things and find pleasure, pursue happiness in that kind of way. And of course, guess who wrote some things about that? Martin Luther. And he has all kinds of comments to make about that. He says the monks and the people are going to escape from the world. Only problem is they don't know what the world is. They've got a wrong definition of the world, and so they get all fouled up. Martin Luther summarizes the whole problem in this way, and wow, our time is running off again. Thus, the subject or matter of this book of Ecclesiastes is simply the human race, which is so foolish that it seeks and strives for many things by its efforts, which it cannot attain, or which, even if it does attain them, it doesn't enjoy, but possesses to its sorrow and harm. When things come flowing in, boredom takes place. If they don't flow in, there's the insatiable desire to have them, and there's no peace. This is the basic problem that he sees in the book of Ecclesiastes. Okay, now let's look at another passage in the book of Ecclesiastes, a couple of quick verses in the New Testament, and we'll break into some triads for just 5 minutes, or maybe 3 minutes, and try to focus on how would you help someone who has this problem. Let's look at, it's still in chapter 2 now, verses 24 through 26. Let's read that out loud first. And before we do this, I've spent so much time in introduction today, which I won't do for the rest of the week, but I felt it was a good idea to establish this since most of you are new, and at least many of you would be benefiting from this introduction. Would one of you read verses 24 through 26, please?
There's nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him who can eat, who can have enjoyment? For to the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and heaping only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and is striving after wind.
Thank you. Romans. Okay, Romans 12, 15. Let's look that up. Romans 12, 15. Romans 12, 15. One of you read that, please. That was kind of good. We did it together. That's a good dramatizing of what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep, not just go around with a big funny grin on your face all the time, no matter who you talk to. Okay, Matthew 6:16. Matthew 6:16. Little exercise in finding Bible verses.
When you pass, do not look visible like hypocrites, but they disfigure their faces so they pass to be seen by men. Really, I say to you, they have received their reward.
Thank you. Would you now divide up into groups of three, or if you don't come out, even four, and just discuss the question, try to formulate, maybe one of you has a piece of paper, formulate a couple things you would say or do for somebody who has reached this bankrupt point in their life, and you know they've tried, pleasure has been their main thing. Okay, divide up now, we'll give you about 4 minutes. Especially on the basis of these last passages which we read. Okay, now, all right, let's roll the tape again. Let's start up on top here. What would you say? And then if somebody says what you would already say, then, you know, you don't need to say yours, but let's have our reports from these groups. Let's start up here. What would you say that might be helpful?
Well, I think we went everything from sharing some of the things that are meaningful in our own lives to reflecting back to that person what we hear them saying.
Okay. Could you all hear that? Say it one more time, good and loud.
Everything from sharing with the person what we find meaningful in our lives to the other extreme of reflecting back to them just what we hear them saying so that they can begin to understand.
Okay, a little active listening plus a little sharing. Okay. All right, over here. Do you have some more groups over here?
I would quote a poster that I saw, a butterfly flying through the woods. Happiness is like a butterfly. The more you pursue it, the more it will elude you. But if you give yourself to other things, it will quietly come and sit on your shoulder. To point out the paradoxes of life, that the more you seek pleasure, probably the less pleasing it will be. But if you give yourself to something bigger than yourself, happiness and joy will surprise you.
Okay. Did you all hear that? Okay. Yeah, try to speak as loud as you can, too, now, so people can hear. That was super. Okay, over here, any others?
A couple different, seek moderation and also stop trying so hard, stop pursuing this.
Seek moderation, stop trying so hard. Okay, let's go down here. Just go ahead and raise your hand and then pop off here. Tell us, share with us what you came up with. Anybody at all back here? Yeah.
Weep with those who weep and rejoice with those who rejoice, and the importance of that.
Okay.
But if you wept together with somebody, you can come to joy again and you can laugh with them.
All right. Be sensitive to how somebody's feeling. Don't just Martin Marty has some beautiful stuff about that in his book, The Cry of Absence. The proverbial person who just, you know, doesn't stop smiling no matter how bad your problem is. And, okay. Over here, anybody else?
Well, we said befriend people first. When this person is possibly hurting, all right, befriend him first and then work him in, perhaps. Then you can...
Uh-huh.
Then you can do other things.
All right, really be sensitive to where they're at. Befriend right. them, and then maybe you can be of help. This is identify with them, okay? Or let's keep on here. Who else? Just go ahead and speak up.
Ours is kind of the same as what they said, that you can't only tell, that you have to kind of show, you have to kind of hold out your arms and embrace them and then take them with you.
Okay. Okay. All right, help. Let's just say it without raising your hand. Just say it. We'll kind of go around this way, though. Anybody over here? Okay. Some of your things have been said now. So, what else is there to be said? What else would you say that hasn't been said before?
I think that to me the first thing is that you need to truly love the person.
Okay, you need to truly love the person
and listen to them.
Listen to them.
Tell them you care.
Tell them you care.
Not be judgmental.
Not be judgmental. You ought to be happy. What's the matter with you? Okay.
They need to raise the premise in the person. Do they have to? Is there any guarantees in life that one is going to have pleasure and be happy?
Ah.
And say that maybe in the midst of this, there is God, to seek God in the midst of that suffering. And to say that might be all that life is going to hold for you. To raise that possibility with the person.
Okay. Did you all hear that? Okay. Good. Excellent. Other thoughts? Yeah.
But he said it corresponds with what we're doing here at Holden Village. We came out here for fun, didn't we? We came out here for inspiration, and we're getting both.
Okay. Okay, so what you're saying then is to...
Yes, in a good time. Out here in a good spiritual way.
Oh, okay. So enjoy the things, the opportunities that you have. That's what you'd say. Okay, okay.
Prayer,
uh-huh.
We talked about taking your mind off yourself and okay. go out and volunteer your
yeah.
services.
Okay, prayer, being in touch with this one who gives us the gifts. Prayer, as we heard so beautifully described last night in the sermon at the Vespers, at the communion service. Taking your mind off yourself, helping other people. Other thoughts, what would you do? What would you say that would be of help?
I think I'd be inclined to encourage the quest. That is to say, there's something in you that is seeking the deepest yearnings that God desires to give to you.
Okay.
So to be encouraging of even the misery of the process that.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Excellent.
To not to leave it, but to continue to follow it, to do the next thing, and say this isn't a quickly solved or resolved.
Uh huh.
Trust that God is working in this restlessness.
Excellent, excellent. Other thoughts.
The tag on that is that advice from Rilke, love the questions.
Yeah. Love the questions.
And follow them.
Ah, okay.
Talk to them and ask them what's bothering them.
Yeah, talk to them.
Feel that you care.
Yeah, just the way you talk to them. Just the way you ask, honor their questions and make them feel that you care. Other things. Let me just, in closing, we got, according to my watch, we have 2 minutes left. And, of course, who else but Martin Luther? And adding a little bit of what Martin Luther says here. Throwing that in for you to think about. And, of course, he makes some comments on the passage, rejoice with those who rejoice. Do not try to be wise and solemn in the midst of those who are rejoicing, as sanctimonious people do, who dampen the happiness of other people, which God has given. Just be sure to acknowledge that all of this comes to you from God, accept it from God's hand, and use it as God's gift. Heavy emphasis here on the gift. Okay, here's another one. As it is a sin to invite anxiety and sorrow by our own counsels. Martin Luther uses that phrase a lot, our own counsels. What does he mean? Oh, I'm going to figure this out my own way. I'm going to do my thing and figure out how my life is going to be on my own way. That is the sure, frustrating way to live, Martin Luther says. It's just a dead end. As it is a sin, he says, to invite anxiety and sorrow by our own counsels, and also a sin to refuse to suffer them when they are imposed on us, so it is also to be condemned if we run away from happiness and do not accept it and do not accept happiness when it is given by God. This is what those sanctimonious killjoys do, he says, when they disfigure their faces, quoting Matthew 6. They seek out places, times, and persons that are gloomy. And they prescribe strict regulations, which is hypocritical and vain. Another one. He talks about the monks and the sophists. This is the other side of it, those who abstain from all these pleasures. The monks and the sophists who did not know what it was to flee from the world. This is, in fact, to teach a contempt for the good creatures of God and to forbid their use, contrary to the clear words of the Holy Scripture. Fleeing the world, therefore, does not mean abstaining from these things, but it means abstaining from your own counsels. I think that's neat. Okay, one more, two more. Thus, outward happiness is indeed a good thing, but only for those who know how to use it well. The wicked, by contrast, even though they are lost in revelry, still are not happy because they do not recognize this as a gift of God and are always bored, dissatisfied with the things that are present, and looking for something else. And one more. This one has to do with how you're raising your kids. Searching for happiness by raising your family. This is a little bit of practical stuff here. And I can identify with this. We got six kids. They're all grown up, more or less. Okay. Okay. He says, you think about how you rear your sons to be decent and useful to the state. But behold, contrary to your expectation, they become criminals or scoundrels of some kind, useless burdens on the earth. What a neat way of putting it for some people. Okay, is that a reason to desert the whole process of raising family and desert my domestic responsibilities because I see that nothing succeeds for all my diligence and that nothing responds to my labors? No. What then? One must, he uses the word rule, but maybe we'd say it differently nowadays. One must work with your household, you found a family, educate the children. He says rule his wife, we'd say something else nowadays. but in such a way that it happens without your measure and your rule, that you do not trust in your own wisdom. If your son is suited for learning the liberal arts, let him learn it. If he's suited for a craft, let him learn that. The important thing is that you not exceed your own limits, but commit this whole business to God. You commit the whole thing to God, God who gave us these gifts.